Okay, Senate State Affairs is called to order. The time is 9:06. It's February the 26th. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Present for the record are Senators Bundy, Stevens, Lynch, and myself, McGuire. We had three items on the agenda today. SJR 12, cruise ship port times and the Jones Act has been postponed at the request of the sponsor. So if you were here for that bill or online, come back later. First up, we will have House Bill 260. We heard that last week by Representative Dugan, State Officers Compensation Commission. And we do have Carl Kurtz online from the National Conference of State Legislators to talk to us about that bill. And after that, we'll have Senate Bill 181, Anatomical Gifts. So, Mr. Kurtz, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
I'm very pleased to be here with you, and I'm sorry about the glitch on Thursday. I was on the line right up until the moment you called me, and then called on me, and then somehow I got disconnected. So, sorry that happened.
Not a problem, and our apologies to you. It could have been our equipment over here. So thank you for coming back again today.
Okay. Well, I'm especially glad to appear before this committee where I have a number of very good friends, and Senator Stevens and Senator Bundy in particular. My greetings to them. I wish I could be there in person.
Madam Chair, good morning, Carla. And I, looking at the weather outside, I think wish we could be with you in person.
Well, I can imagine that. Let me say that I am appearing at Representative Dugan's request, but I am not taking a position on this bill. What I intend to do here is to try to give you some perspective on what's going on around the country, both with legislative salaries and with compensation commissions. And I'm going to be working off of some PowerPoint slides that I have. My understanding is that you have hard copy of those slides. Is that correct?
Yes, we do.
Good. Well, let me begin by saying that what I try to do across the country for all the states is to estimate the actual compensation that legislators receive. And this is not always an easy thing to do because different states have different ways of doing it, and there's a kind of a proliferation of per diem payments and other things, often to get around constitutional limitations in their salaries or just the political difficulty of legislators raising their own salary. So I try to look at each one of the states and try to figure out what the IRS would count as the compensation on which legislators have to pay taxes. So I include in that salary, per diem payments, both for the session and the interim, and that implies then that I also make estimates of how many days they get those per diem payments. And then finally, any other unvouchered expense payments. When I do this, I generally exclude any special leadership or committee chair compensation. I'm just looking at the rank and file members. So if you look at the first map in your...
Yeah, Senator French, Mr. Kurtz, Senator French wants to jump in here.
Sure.
Know where his compensation is, the judiciary chair.
That's right.
No, that wasn't my question, but now that you bring it up. No, my question is about what an unvouchered expense payment is.
In some states, you might get a $1,000 payment for office expenses, but if you don't have to submit a voucher proving that you used it for office expenses, then you can use it as income.
I understand.
Yeah. Office account.
So anything you don't have to submit an expense report for or a bill for.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So if you look at the first map, which is in shades of purple and pink, I guess, you can see my estimates within fairly broad ranges of what legislators are paid around the country. There are seven legislatures in the darkest kind of purple color there that are where the pay is over $60,000 a year. Then there are another seven states in the second category from 45 to 60,000. And then the largest category is the one Alaska is in of between 30,000 and 45,000. And there are 11 states then in the 15 to 30,000 category and nine in the less than 15,000 with the champion in that category being New Hampshire, where they get $100 a year total. And maybe that points out that you know, these ranges are fairly broad, so they encompass substantial differences.
Senator Bundy wants to jump in.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Carl, in the Alaska category, that includes our regular salary and then some average of the long-term per diem that legislators claim. Is that?
Yes, and right. The number I'm using for Alaska is actually about $33,000, and I came up with that number in preparation for this meeting through consultation with Pam Varney and the person on his staff whose name I've forgotten who handles those, on Pam's staff who handles those vouchers. So that's actually her average of what the total amount that legislators receive.
Yeah, thank you. And I just, for your information, I think that varies from people who claim no long-term per diem to some rumored that claim almost every day of the year. So, and just to put a finer point on it for an issue that I'll bring up later, this long-term per diem is, from your view, what IRS would be considered as salary.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Okay.
And that's a good point. And again, it emphasizes that these are average numbers and different legislators claim different amounts. If you go to the next map, this is something I need to introduce in order to make sense out of these numbers. We usually divide legislatures around the country into three different levels of what political scientists usually call professionalization. And the states that are in red on this map are the ones that are full-time legislatures. They're paid enough that people can make a living just being in the legislature, and they have quite large staff. So those three measures, the amount of compensation, the amount of time required by the job, and the size of the staff are what goes into this measure of professionalization. So there are about 10 states in the red category. The blue category are the classic citizen legislatures like New Hampshire that I was mentioning with their $100 a day pay, most of the Rocky Mountain states. They're very part-time, their pay is very low, and they have very few staff. And there are, I think, 16 or 17 states in that category. Then in between that, almost half the states are in a hybrid category that has some elements of either the red or the blue. And in the testimony that you received on Thursday, I believe it was Senator Elton who referred to this classification and mentioned that we put Alaska into a kind of light red category, that you were verging on the red. And in fact, he was accurate at one point, but it was in the course of my preparation for this testimony that I got a better fix on how much you actually earn. And changing your reducing your compensation resulted in Alaska going back into this hybrid category that's shown in white on this map. So any question on that point before I continue?
No.
Okay. So with this categorization as background, that introduces the next couple of slides that shows the average compensation within each one of those three categories of red, white, and blue legislatures. And just for fun here, I've added in the Congress. I've put in bars that show where Alaska is on this scale. And you can see on this slide that in the white category, the average is pretty close to 40,000. So Alaska is just slightly below that. Blue states are down below 18,000, and the red states are at about $75,000 on average. And on this slide, it looks like over the 35-year period of time that I've been calculating these numbers, that there's been substantial increases in each category. But if you go to the next slide and you correct for inflation, then you can see that the Congress in particular has had a pay cut in real terms over this period of time. And for the most part, the states have stayed the same. You in Alaska have had, in real terms, about a 30% pay cut since 1972, at least according to my calculations. That's really the overview of what legislators are actually paid. I'm going to go on now to talk about methods that they use for setting these salaries. On the next map, you can see a slide that shows most of the states in the darkest color here, the kind of brownish red. The great bulk of the states, the legislature itself is responsible for setting its own salaries. And most states don't have any commission at all. There are two other states besides Alaska that have compensation commissions on the books, but they're inactive, and they're in this category. And let me say generally about this map that the darker the color, the more the legislature has responsibility, or the other way of looking at it is the lighter the color, the less the legislature has control over its own salaries. So the second category of states on this slide, the one that's, I don't know, I guess kind of salmon colored, are ones where there is a commission, and the commission makes recommendations, and it's up to the legislature as to whether or not it accepts those recommendations. And those states are Connecticut, Maine, Minnesota, Virginia, and West Virginia. Then the third category that's kind of getting into pink is where there is a commission, and the commission acts and their action is implemented unless it is rejected, and various states have different methods of rejection. Sometimes it's the legislature, sometimes it's the governor, and in a few instances, it's even the voters who determine to reject a commission recommendation. And so those states are Arizona, Delaware, Hawaii, Maryland, Michigan, and Missouri, and it's the way I understand is the proposal for House Bill 260 in Alaska. The fourth category, then, is ones where the salaries are tied automatically to some kind of an index. In some states, it's an index of what state workers are paid. So if all state workers get a X percent increase, then legislators get that increase. In other states, it may be tied to some kind of an economic index in that state. And these are completely automatic without any action by the legislature. And the states in those categories are Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, Montana, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Interestingly, those are all pretty large population states except for Montana. And then the last category, there's only one state in it, the state of Washington, where they have a commission that actually sets the salaries every 2 years. And the only way that's overturned is if there is an initiative by the voters to reject that. So that's kind of the range of methods that are out there for compensation. I guess I'll conclude with that and take any questions or comments.
Okay, questions. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Carl. As always, you did an excellent job, and I know this is maybe getting in an area that is really you may not be willing to comment on, but we've had enormous problems here in Alaska. You may not be aware of it, ethical issues and lawsuits and prison terms and just a terrible situation that we've all suffered through. We passed laws on ethics. I don't know if the maker of this, creator of this bill, had any intention of trying to address that issue, but do you think there is a connection between a lack of ethics or ethical issues in states and unfair compensation? Or is there a connection there at all?
Well, it would be a very difficult one to prove. You know, the Congress is the only one of the 51 legislatures in the United States that bans all outside income. And that's the principle on which they try to pay enough to legislators. The Congress occasionally has its own ethical problems. And so I'm not sure that you could draw a strong correlation between amount that's paid to legislators and instances of corruption, if that's what you're asking.
Well, thank you, Carl. That is what I'm asking, and I understand pretty much a very difficult difficult for you to give a response. I do understand that, but thanks for your comments.
And Mr. Kurtz, I thought California also had a ban similar to that of Congress regarding outside employment.
I don't think it's for outside employment. They may have a ban on honoraria.
Okay.
But if you're an attorney in California or an insurance agent, you can still get, to the extent that you can have time to practice those activities, or if you're a farmer, then you can still earn that income.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any further questions for Mr. Kurtz? Okay. Seeing none, anyone else here in the audience? I'll reopen public testimony if there's anyone here to testify on House Bill 260. Anyone online? Okay, so that has brings the bill before us. There's one amendment by Senator Bundy. Call it Amendment Number 1. Senator Bundy?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move that Amendment Number 1.
Okay, I'll object just to have you explain it. Yeah.
Yeah. By a little way of a little background, I've, as you know, probably been concerned for some time about truth in labeling and that compensation we receive that we pay taxes on, by definition, should not be called per diem. It's not the most accurate label. And I was going to attempt in this amendment to be a little more expansive and ask that the commission look at that issue and determine if salary is a better definition of what is currently called long-term per diem. Was told by Ledge Legal that we actually cannot do that, even though Ledge Council is a creature of the legislature. We can't tell them apparently what to do when it comes to deciding what is salary and what is per diem. Seems a little strange, but
Madam Chair, are we discussing the amendment or the letter of intent?
The amendment. I'm just why I've gotten to this. And so I've narrowed the amendment down to focus on what I view as the intent of per diem, and that is when you must move from one area to another and take up temporary residence. Obviously, equal pay for equal work is an issue we hear often about, and currently, under current situation, when we're people who reside permanently in Juneau are paid a per diem. Now, I think it's an attempt to try to equalize salaries, but again, it's in an inaccurate use of the term per diem, and one that I don't think passes the public's red face test. So this amendment then is an attempt to suggest that if you live within 50 miles of where the legislature is convened, and I'm willing to discuss the distance, whether it's 50 miles or 20 miles or what would be most appropriate, a 50-mile commute seems something that you could do daily, but in any case, that a legislator who is a permanent residence within 50 miles of where the legislature convenes ought not to be subject to to a per diem allowance if this commission in their wisdom wanted to give them an increase in salary. That would be something else, but it's just not an accurate use of the term per diem.
Okay, and so right at this minute we just have the amendment before us. We'll take up the letter separate. So discussion on amendment number 1. Senator Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator French and Senator Green.
Madam Chair, I think we've had this little battle before in the committee, but my view is that the topics that the amendment seeks to address is exactly what the commission should do in its sort of studied consideration. The commission can figure out if there is an increase in the day-to-day expenses of a Juneau legislator during the session. The commission can figure out whether there are some places that may be near Juneau but are cut off from the road system that require, for example, a lodge owner or a cabin owner or a miner somewhere to travel to Juneau, who may live near here but travel to Juneau and have an apartment. And so I appreciate the idea to sort of treat everybody fairly, but I think that this is a topic that the commission should study and not us kind of here on the fly.
Senator Green?
You stated my opposition very well. I think this should be a commission consideration.
Further discussion? Amendment number 1. Senator Bundy.
And I appreciate that point of view, and I think it makes my point. We ought to be telling the commission they ought to study this, and that amendment would do that.
Okay. Madam Secretary, you want to call the roll on amendment number 1?
Senator Green.
No.
Senator French.
No.
Senator Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Chair McGuire?
I'll give you a yes.
Lethal.
And so the amendment fails. So we have the letter of intent before us. Now, Senator Bundy, that amendment number one has failed. Is the letter of intent separate, something you still want to offer?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And again, I understand the, you know, the commission should have a broad scope, but because of the problem with Ledge Council not being apparently under the direction of the legislature, I think that we ought to encourage the commission to review the term long-term per diem and see if it's more accurately defined as salary.
Now, how, Senator Bundy, how is it that you think that the bill and the discussion that we've had behind it doesn't give enough authority to the commission to discuss this topic? Because I feel like we talked last week quite a bit about this idea.
Yeah, Madam Chair, without this letter, the commission may choose to ignore that issue. With the letter, they're more inclined to take up the issue. It doesn't say that they will ignore it, but they certainly could if they chose to.
Okay. Well, yeah, Senator Green?
Did I understand you to say, Madam Chair, I was wondering, did I understand you to say that the folks you talked to, I guess it was legal, had said that long-term per diem is salary?
No, I hope I didn't indicate that. That Ledge Legal said that what is defined, or the term long-term per diem versus salary is a creature of Ledge Council, and we can't tell them to change that. Ledge Council has chosen the term long-term per diem versus salary, I would think, is kind of a subterfuge in saying we don't have a very big salary. But as Mr. Kurtz indicated, IRS views it as salary, and we're taxed on it. So we can't tell Ledge Council legally, apparently, how to define these terms. I'm just suggesting that as an extension of our discussion, that we ought to encourage this commission, should it be established, to review those, the accuracy of those terms.
I guess my only concern, though, too, is it is quite a directive. It says instruct them to review and redefine. I feel like we've made it pretty clear on the record, but I guess to make it more clear today, that we do anticipate that the commission will look at all of these terms, all of the compensation, and I think the conversation that we also had was that there might be legitimate expenses that people who come from, Senator Green discussed her area or other areas, to do legislative work, there might actually be gas or things that would be historically under a per diem construct. So I guess my only concern is just that we're saying you have to redefine it, and I don't know whether we want to be that instructive. But
Madam Chair,
Senator Bundy,
as the letter is labeled conceptual, I would certainly be comfortable with saying that it's the intent to encourage this commission to review.
Okay, and I guess my only question is why we would need a letter of intent on this subject versus all of the subjects that are there. If we would want to highlight this more than any other subject that we want the commission to consider. Yeah.
Well, again, Madam Chair, and it may be just a foible of mine, but as the IRS, as Mr. Kurtz, as I'm sure any accountant would say, what we call long-term per diem is salary, and we should have clear and transparent, or at least accuracy in our labeling, and I've just often been counseled to be careful to ascribe motives to other people, but I think when long-term per diem was originally put in, it was put in as a subterfuge to hide additional salary.
Okay, let's take a brief at ease. It is 9:40, and we have a letter of intent before us. Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, even though math isn't my strong suit, I can count. And I will withdraw the letter of intent.
Okay. And let the record reflect that good statements have been made on the subject, and I think there'll be an opportunity, should the commission like, to hear testimony. All right. So with that, we have the bill before us, unamended. Is there a motion? Senator French.
Madam Chair, I'd be pleased to move that HB 260 be passed out of the onto the next committee referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Okay. Is there an objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 260 has moved. Congratulations, Representative Dugan. Okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And next, yes, and next we have Senate Bill 181. Trevor. This is a uniform cleanup bill of mine.
Should we just vote?
Yes, we could, Senator Stevens. Trevor, you want to put yourself on the record and walk the committee through it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 181. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton, and I am staff for the Honorable Senator Lisa McGuire. So if you have the bill in front of you, I'm sure you noticed it's a hefty 24 pages in length, and although it is somewhat lengthy, and it is in nature a technical bill, Senate Bill 181 is really a fairly straightforward bill in that it simply aims to save lives. Senate Bill 181 updates and clarifies Alaskan statutes governing anatomical gifts in order to ensure that badly needed organ and tissue donations get to those who need them. There have been significant changes in the donation and transplantation field over the years. Senate Bill 181 draws on a piece of federal legislation known as the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act to bring Alaska statutes into sync with those changes. The UAGA has served to harmonize anatomical gift laws in all 50 states for over 40 years now, and we think it's a very good template. While drafting Senate Bill 181, we worked with the Department of Law, the Department of Health and Social Services, the State Medical Examiner's Office, Life Alaska Donor Services, and with representatives of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws to ensure we drafted a sound piece of legislation, and we are proud of the result. At this very moment, an estimated 180 Alaskans are in need of a life-saving transplant and waiting for a donated organ to become available. Hundreds more are waiting for tissue transplants. By improving anatomical gift law in Alaska, Senate Bill 181 encourages and facilitates badly needed organ donations, donations that save and improve lives all over the state and throughout the country. Members of the committee, I thank you again for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 181, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I certainly supported the original organ donation bill. A donor, and then when Dr. McGuire discussed tissue donation as an addition, supported that. Is this just legalese that we're dealing with, that we have to dot some I's and cross some T's? Why is the additional legislation basically a third time to address this?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, it's my understanding that it is not just legalese, it's not just dotting T's and crosses I's. I mean, there are 24 pages of changes there, but essentially it's not considerably extending any power or authority there. It really is just bringing Alaska statutes up to speed with the federal Uniform Anatomical Gift Act.
And we have Senator Bundy's, we've got Deb Baer with the Department of Law, who oversees the Uniform Acts. We have Jay Butler with the Department of Health and Social Services. We have Bruce Elneritis with Life Alaska Donor Services. And then Mike Garrity, a Uniform Law Commissioner. And maybe we could start with Mike Garrity, do you want to, you're a uniform law commissioner, you want to talk a little bit about why we need to update the uniform law?
Yes, this is Mike Garrity. Can the committee hear me?
Yes.
Well, let me, I had the statement here, but I can just try to summarize for Senator Bundy the changes that have been made. As was pointed out, the original act was passed in 1968 by all 50 states and the District of Columbia. So during that period of time, there's been a lot of experience that can be drawn on. There have been a number of changes in transplantation therapy and changes dealing with electronic records, for example. And so the revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which was just promulgated, I should point out, by the National Conference of Uniform Law Commissioners in 2006, and I'm a Uniform Law Commissioner, and since 2006, it's already been adopted in over 20 states in substantially the same form that's in the committee substitute here. But generally, what the bill does, first of all, it strengthens first-person consent to make a donation of an individual's organs, eyes, and tissues. The act strengthens that decision and it bars others from amending or revoking a gift once that donor decision has been made. In addition, absent first-person consent, gifts by family members and agents are facilitated if the deceased has not acted to make or, for instance, refused to make an anatomical gift. This is done by expanding those that can act to include a healthcare agent, as it's referred to in the act, or a grandchild or other person that exhibits special care, and by clarifying the manner in which consent may be obtained. So in other words, if a person has not made a decision to refuse to make a gift, which a person is free to refuse to make a gift, and that decision, once it's made, is honored and can't be changed. But for someone on their deathbed, if they're brain dead or something like that, and can't make a decision, and if during that person's life they've never made a decision to revoke a gift, the act outlines and clarifies who it is that can make a decision on behalf of that person to make a gift on their behalf, and the procedures that have to be followed. Another thing that the bill does is it outlines how donor registries can be used, and state-issued identification cards are authorized, for example, which that's a recent development that wasn't in place when the original act was passed. But since then, a number of states have created state-sponsored registries, the use of gift identification cards and so on. And Alaska, by the way, is one of those states. The bill also provides for cooperation and coordination between procurement organizations and medical examiners. That's something that we worked with the Department of Health and Social Services on quite closely to come up with, to make sure that they were comfortable with what the act provided, and to minimize conflicts, for example, when a potential donor is also under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner because there's been some crime or other circumstance. And it clarifies how those the donor organization can work with the medical examiner's office to still maximize the chances of getting a donation that doesn't interfere with the investigation and so on. So there's rules in there and a protocol for dealing with those types of conflicts or potential conflicts. And finally, it just generally speaking, it harmonizes the Uniform Act with federal law and current practices. Another area that's a recent development, or since the original act was passed, for example, is the use of do not resuscitate decisions, what they call healthcare directives. And the new act and the new bill harmonizes those procedures when a person's made a decision to not resuscitate, for example, and how the same person, for example, has made a decision to give it an organ donation. So, and how the medical providers are to deal with that situation. And again, simply to harmonize the law, minimize conflicts, and to bring the original act up to date. So that's, in a summary, that's not my complete statement, but I will stop right there and see if there's additional questions.
And thank you, Mr. Garrity. Maybe just briefly, too, uniform laws, some statement about uniform laws and why it's good for states to participate in those uniform laws.
Well, certainly, Madam Chairman, there is an entity called the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform Laws. It's been around since shortly after the turn of the, I think it was 1913, I want to say 1916 perhaps. But the purpose of the National Conference is to create an organization whose purpose is to identify areas or topics where uniform laws amongst the various states would be beneficial. People may have heard of the Uniform Commercial Code, for example. Businesses need to deal with uniform laws when they cross state lines, for example. When a need is recognized for uniform law in a particular area, the National Conference of Commissioners takes up the task of drafting those laws with input from others, obviously. Each state has several commissioners. I'm one from Alaska. And eventually they come up, after much deliberation and consideration, with a Uniform Act, and that is put out there for the 50 states. One area where uniformity is really important is organ donation. It goes without saying that organ donations, these transplantation decisions, for example, need to be made within minutes and hours of the death of a decedent in order for the organs and tissue to be viable for transplantation and therapy. Most transplantations occur in interstate commerce. The donor may be in one jurisdiction. The recipient is probably in another jurisdiction. The donor's family may live yet in another jurisdiction. There is little time to spare, and uniformity and being on the same page is critically important in facilitating organ and tissue transplantation therapy. So, as I said, this was recognized many years ago when the original act was passed and promulgated, and it's worked very effectively since then, but there are some things that have been learned, and the National Conference took it upon itself to come up with a revised act, which I said was promulgated in 2006, and since then, many states have acted quickly to adopt it, and we sincerely hope Alaska joins them.
Senator Bundy?
I hope I answered the chairman's question.
Hey, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. Maybe just help me understand here. Most people you hear have transplants. If it's something they can plan on, they go outside, like Representative Foster is in Seattle, I think, we're getting a transplant. So I understand why we'd want to be a part of, harmonized with the federal program, but is this something we see happening more in Alaska? Are there transplants occurring here more than in the past? Is it an issue that we can expect the medical people to be more involved in?
Well, this is Mike Garrity again. Senator, I'm not a doctor, and I don't know that I have specific information on that. I might defer that question to Bruce Zalnaritis, who's here with me in the conference room. He's the executive director of Life Alaska Donor Services and a doctor to boot. And so Mr. Zalnaritis probably have better information on that specific question, Senator, if I may.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Senator Stevens, and through the chair. In Alaska, we do not do organ transplants at this time. We do, however, do many tissue transplants, and close to 1,000 of those are done annually. All of our organ recipients for heart, liver, kidney, pancreas, lung transplants are, for the most part, done in the greater Seattle hospitals, University of Washington, Swedish, Virginia Mason, sometimes Sacred Heart, which is over in Spokane. Those are the organ centers, and one of the reasons for organ transplants being done in specific centers is the ability to perform these procedures in frequency enough to attain expertise, not only for the surgical part, but for the post-operative care, immunology, infectious disease, diagnostics. So you'll see transplants around the country being done at very specific centers in the main cities around the United States. So Alaskans, for the most part. So when we have a donor in Alaska, an organ donor, those organs are made available to the patients in the Northwest, which includes Alaskans.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood. So we're not really creating a law here that's going to have much impact on Alaskan hospitals, because we don't do organ transplants, but I assume it has an impact on Alaskan donors who then are willing to donate an organ at an outside hospital?
Well, the donation would take place in Alaska, and the donor hospital would be here in Alaska, and the organs would then be transported to the transplant center via commercial or charter aircraft.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, and Mr. Zonaritis, did you want to go ahead and offer more testimony on the bill itself while you're there?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I would just like to simply echo Mike Garrity's comments, and I'd like to state that there are close to 100,000 patients waiting for an organ transplant in the United States. About 180 of those are Alaskans, and about 18 people in the United States die each day while waiting for a transplant that never comes. It is important to simplify and clarify the process of becoming an organ and tissue donor. Senate Bill 181 will update the Alaska's Uniform Anatomical Gift Act to the 2006 version, as Mike Garrity has stated, from the 1987 version, will remove obstacles to organ and tissue donation by clarifying language on who can grant consent. It also recognizes the benefits of donor registries, of which we have a very successful donor registry that began in 2004, with now, as I sit here, 330,000 Alaskans are on the donor registry, growing at about 800 per week. Wow. And most of those are through the Department of Motor Vehicle signups. The revised UAGA would also prioritize donations for transplantation over research, education, and other uses. SB 181 would further improve the relationship between the donation organizations, Life Alaska, for example, and the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner plays a key role in the donation process, as most organ and tissue donations involve sudden, unexpected deaths, which fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner. Thank you. I'm available for questions, of course.
Questions for Mr. Zonaritis. Senator Bundy.
Well, just a comment to the committee. You know, we had talked about another issue about driver's license, and if we're 800 donors signing up, we've got to assume there's far more driver's license than that issued each week. No wonder we probably ought to assure that the people are actually accurate in their application.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, we do have Whitney Brewster and Carrie Hennings on the line from the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster. I'm the Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. We do not oppose this legislation in any way, and I am available to answer questions about the program as it is implemented at the DMV if the committee members have any questions.
Okay, question. Senator Bundy.
Is that number accurate, that there are 800 new donors a week, and how many driver's licenses do we issue new per week?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I'm sorry, I do not have that information in front of me at this time, but I do know that the bulk of the registry does come through the DMV. It's my understanding that it's close to 90%. Yeah. I would be happy to get you the number of driver's licenses we issue each week.
Yeah, thank you, if you would.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, it's Bruce Zonaritis again. We have statistics on the number of signups by all means, internet, filling out a document on the DMV. And the DMV at the current time is higher than 98% of all signups.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that service is available. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And then we also have Roberta Pyra online.
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Did I do a bad job on your last name?
No, you did just fine.
Okay, my apologies. If you want to go ahead and offer your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
I'm here today testifying as a donor mom. I just want to testify of the importance of the registry that has been put in place since my son passed in 2001. When he went to get his license at 16 in 2001, actually, he was asked if he wanted to be an organ and tissue donor and not knowing anything about it, it was just turned into more of a, you know, just a joking matter. He was way too young. What would his organs be needed for? So on and so forth. Unfortunately, 6 months later, it came up again. Unfortunately, the decision was put on to myself and my husband to make my son an organ and tissue donor. The decision to do that came easily once we based it on what my son would have chosen to do himself. I want to testify that it's important that the youth know about the organ and tissue transplant process, what it's all about, that it's not a scary thing, that it's something to help and benefit others. And I'm proud to say that my son has, in his donation, has saved the lives and have improved the lives of 13 individuals in the Northwest. To wrap up, I just want to testify that it is important that the youth know, and the registry with the DMV is a very important matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I know it was hard to offer that. We appreciate hearing it from the committee. Next is Robert Meyer. Mr. Meyer, are you there?
Yes, I am. This is Rob Meyer. I'm a CPA and have been a resident of Anchorage since 1969. I am also a heart transplant recipient twice over, and received my my transplants in August of 2003 at the University of Washington. And along with my family and others, I have two very special families to thank for my my continued life and enjoyment of my family. I want to speak to the importance of streamlining the process for organ and tissue donation, as it's, I think, an extremely important thing. And I want to emphasize that the faster the process can take place, the better, because the weight from the recipient side and the family members of the recipient is an agonizing affair. And it can last quite a long time. For me, in hindsight, it was relatively short. I was medevaced to the University of Washington in April of 2003 and received my first transplant at the end of August. That transplant failed on the table, and I was kept alive by a BiVAD machine for an additional four-day period, when I was fortunate enough to receive a second transplant from a young man in Montana. So my wait was relatively short. There are people who have been waiting, as you've noticed in the newspaper recently and on the media, a young child at Stanford in California has been there for over close to 2 years now, I believe. So anything that we can do to simplify and create some uniformity in the process, I think would be very helpful. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Mr. Meyer? Thank you very much. And I want to say thank you to you guys for wading through the earlier bill to the presentation. Is there anyone else online that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 181? Is there anyone here in the audience? Okay. Yeah, there is. Okay. If you want to come forward and put your name on the record. Good morning.
Hello, my name is Schaefer Cox. I'm from Fairbanks. I just flew down here on a whim to visit the Capitol and happened to sit in on this meeting. Great. And I would, just listening to your bill, I think that it's great. I would caution everyone, though, to maintain a vigilant stance towards the sanctity of human life and be very careful that we never, never ever slide off into valuing one life over another, mm-hmm. or put anyone or anything in the position of doing that. And I would urge you guys to all make sure that there are provisions that recognize the individual sanctity of human life and the equal sanctity of human life in this bill, because there is a danger that some people may be deemed somehow less worthy, whether that be for mental capacity or in the far-reaching scheme of things for sheer economic reasons, and that's a danger that we run. I know that in some countries the overcrowded prisons have been a source of organ and tissue transplants, and we don't want to start down that road. So my request and my admonition would be to never stop to recognize the sanctity of the human life, both the one that needs the organ, but also the sanctity of the person that had their organs to begin with.
Very, very good points. Thank you. It's nice to see citizens come to your Capitol and get involved. And I appreciate the statements that you made on the record as these bills have gone through over the years before my time and during my time. That debate always occurs, and it's a good one. This one is more of a cleanup bill, but there are specific provisions in the organ and tissue donation statutes that that do make those proclamations and rules governing who can give and how you can give and so forth. And certainly Alaska joins with the rest of our United States in not allowing any profit or any involuntary giving up of your tissue and organs. So those things are, you know, continue to be protected. But it's nice to hear your testimony. Questions or comments?
Madam Chair,
Senator Green.
In some of the information that I think would pertain to his comments, there's this strengthens that, because it refers to after death, not upon death. And that was, I think, in past times, sort of a critical decision-making time. So I would just say this probably strengthens it in regards to what you're talking about.
Okay, thank you. So we'll, that brings the bill back before us. We'll set it aside to give people time to digest and look it through to be sure that the changes are all the ones that people want to make to the uniform law. And I appreciate all the testimony, and we'll go ahead and adjourn for the day. Now, here's the